Good evening, everyone. Charles Moskowitz, welcome to the program. Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. to midnight, usually, although this being the internet, I'm kind of free to do it anytime I want, and I have a lot of guests who can't do it at this hour, so you might see me pop up in different times from time to time. And my guest this segment is Dr. Michael J. Zima. He is the author of Modern Healthcare Delivery, Deliverance or Debacle, A Glimpse from the Inside Out. Dr. Zima, thank you for joining me.
You're quite welcome, Charles.
So you've published this book. It's available on Amazon. Let's get right into it. What is the basic premise of your book?
Charles, I was struck by the general level of naivety that the population has, not just my peers, but individuals in general, so-called pundits on TV, radio, who often confuse Medicare with Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And I said, after 40 years in the business, if you will, of healthcare, I need to sit down, put pen to paper, and bring some cohesiveness to the gobbledygook which is out there.
Well, then this is our chance to learn something and to get a little educated. My understanding is that Medicaid became part of the national fabric in 1949 as an addendum to the Social Security Act of 1936, which basically provided health care for indigent people and was brought about through matching funds by the states, whereas Medicare was part of the Johnson era Act of 1965, which has to do with mandatory retirement insurance for all Americans, an aspect of it which covers healthcare costs. Is that a thumbnail on that, or?
Charles, you may be one up on me on that. Title 19, I think it was, and Title 20, both with Johnson, one with Medicare and one with Medicaid in the mid-60s with LBJ. Harry Truman did try in the early 40s, actually, to advocate universal care for all. Mm. It died on the starting gate. And then he came back a little bit later came back, I think, in the early 50s, around 1950, and tried to promulgate it for individuals over 65. So he was actually trying to promulgate Medicare at that time. And it also died in the starting gate.
I actually stand corrected. I think that I'm confusing, and here we go, like as typical of most of us, right? I'm confusing Medicaid with an aspect of the Social Security Act that deals with disability coverage and other elements, an expansion of Social Security, which happened in 1949.
That may indeed be.
Okay. So we have a system in this country where, first of all Americans over 65 automatically get Medicare. And that includes people who did not necessarily work in this country or pay into the FICA, which is goes toward Medicare. You pay for Medicare your entire working life. Every paycheck that you get, you see a little thing called FICA, F-I-C-A. And that is taken out of your wages, and a portion of that goes toward Medicare. So you're entitled to Medicare. That's not welfare. That's something you earn. And that kicks in at 65, type A. Part B is a little bit more complicated because that requires some extra payment in, and that gives you a slightly more expanded service. And Part C, which was passed actually in the George W. Bush administration, that deals with pharmaceutical coverage, I think, or am I wrong?
You're doing pretty well, Charles. I'm going to give you a C to B for the grade.
Okay.
I think you have to pay your FICA, I could be off on this, for 5 years before you're, quote, entitled.
Okay.
But you're absolutely right. Think about this. Someone who started working at age 30 and paid their FICA for 35 years until they were 65 years of age, gets the same benefit as somebody who started paying their FICA at 59 and a half and retires at 65 years of age. But in that in that sense, Medicare is it's a health insurance product, as opposed to, and as a health insurance product, you're right, it's paid for largely, at least Part A, it's paid for largely with you know, your FICA premiums that go toward the policy, as opposed to Medicaid, which I think is a true entitlement.
It is. Yeah.
It is a legal entitlement that you get because you're indigent, cannot afford health care, but you haven't paid into the system. It's something it's done and through general taxation.
It's general taxation with matching funds from the states. Now, there's another bill that was passed, I think in the 80s, actually, it might have been as recently, which basically guarantees all Americans or anyone in America health care if they show up in an emergency room at a hospital without worrying about having to pay for it. Is that true?
That's the EMTALA provision, yes. Okay. I believe it's spelled E-M-T-A-L-A. The EMTALA.
And when did that become the law of the land?
I think you're not far off on target. I know I was actively practicing when EMTALA came through. Yeah, and that's what it says. And unfortunately, as you might imagine, EMTALA can certainly get abused.
Well, sure. People end up using it for their own, you know, they show up in emergency rooms and crowd them and there's not an emergency.
Right. They're using it as their primary care.
That's right. Facility. The all of this was in place when Obama became president. You basically had coverage for the indigent nationally, varying in different states, with a list of doctors who subscribed to it. You had Medicare, which was for retirement, and you had the hospital coverage for emergencies. What did Obamacare add to the mix, the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, he was trying to make healthcare more affordable, if you will, for the working individual under age 65 who wasn't poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, but could not afford 20 or 30% of their gross revenue to pay for healthcare insurance.
So healthcare insurance and healthcare had become so expensive, the premise was at that point, that the federal government had to come in and subsidize lower levels of income. But it didn't necessarily disqualify people who could afford insurance.
No, and in fact, at least pre-COVID pandemic, the original ACA bill, Obamacare, if you were eligible for it, the subsidy that you got toward your insurance premium ended at 400% of the federal poverty level. Above that, you were not able to get any subsidy at all. And the subsidies were graded below that all the way down to the federal poverty level.
Now, was there an aspect of Obamacare that was mandatory? Because I remember at the time there was people were saying that you had to have this policy. The deductible was something, it could be upwards of $5,000 before you could even get to it. And the cost actually didn't go down.
Yeah, that was the mandatory or the mandate that was repealed during Donald Trump's presidency. Yeah, the mandate was, yes, you had to have healthcare insurance. And I'm thinking the rationale for that was, we didn't want you to go into the emergency room using EMTALA to get your care because that's more expensive. The problem with it, you alluded to it, the problem with it was that, you know, the deductibles were very, very high. The premiums were there. If you were a well, healthy, you know, 24-year-old jock who ran around the track all day, you didn't really want to pay that.
That's right. And I think that Trump rescinded that aspect of it, while at the same time he left in place elements that were popular, such as that you can your child or a young person could stay on your policy up to the age of 26. And that the catastrophic care, that if you had a catastrophic illness that insurance companies wouldn't cover because it was too expensive, you could have a default coverage, a secondary insurance, subsidized by the government, which I think is something that we all want. You know, nobody wants to see somebody die from a rare disease because they can't afford to pay for it.
There are really two parts to the Affordable Care Act, Charles. The first part dealt with the exchanges, where you're buying insurance, in essence, through the private marketplace, but you're being subsidized depending upon your income relative to the federal poverty limit. The second part, which I think was probably just as important, if you look at the enrollment in the first 3 or 4 years, more people went into the second part than the exchanges. The second part was the modification of Medicaid criteria to achieve a Medicaid status. The federal government was not going to subsidize the states who did not buy into the changes in Medicaid that were promulgated through Obamacare.
And those changes were simply an expansion of Medicaid, is that right, mostly?
Yeah. In other words, the original Medicaid had, you know, provision, you were eligible for it if you were, I'm just throwing things out here now because I don't have the exact information, but if you were a couple, then you had to have an income less than 130% of the federal poverty level. But if you were a childless adult, you got zero.
Okay.
Obamacare said, you know, everybody's going to have 138% of the federal poverty level. I'm getting rid of all these different categories, single, married, I'm leveling the playing field. And that, you know, you could argue was, you know, trying to make some sense out of a law that was passed in the 60s and was just, you know, chipped away over the years.
Now, when did the HIPAA laws kick in? Now, my understanding is that HIPAA is a very complex body of laws, and much of which is contradictory. We're talking, you know, thousands of pages that regulate just about every aspect of the relationship between the patient and the doctor and the hospital, all elements of it. And it sort of explains why it is that when you see your doctor today, the doctor spends a lot less time looking at you and more time looking at the computer screen and doing paperwork, and that doctors and dog practices and hospitals have had higher staffs of paper pushers just to keep up with it. Am I right about that?
Well, I think HIPAA probably had less of a role in it than the actual billing and reimbursement to providers and hospitals. Let me try to separate those. HIPAA is Health Insurance Portability Act, blah, 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 blah. It basically is a privacy act so that your information is private to you. Now, it became a little ludicrous.
With the vaccines.
When I go to the doctor now and I sit in the office waiting for my turn, I hear, Michael, they're not allowed to use my last name. You see, God forbid someone might know that Zima is in the waiting room to see the doctor. So it becomes a little bit ludicrous, but many of the provisions of HIPAA were good. I mean,
okay. I think it's important to have privacy protection. However, it was contradicted by the vaccine, with the COVID vaccine, which is a subject we can't even talk about on YouTube. Apparently, for whatever reason, it's verboten. But the fact is that all of a sudden it became not only legal, but mandatory that businesses, especially public agencies, could ask you your status regarding the vaccine.
Correct.
And you would have to show proof of getting it, which seems to me to be a contradiction in the letter and spirit of the HIPAA laws.
I agree with you. It's a violation of HIPAA that was brushed under the rug by the Justice Department because, you know, this is a federal medical emergency status that we are in with COVID. But getting back to your original question about the electronic medical record and the amount of time, energy, and resources devoted to keeping the digital record. Remember, I talk about this extensively in the first chapter of my book. Where did the EMR, the electronic medical record, come from? It came out of, you know, Hurricane Katrina and the thousands of records that were destroyed. People woke up and said, you know, the paper record, which has served us for decades, probably is no longer adequate in this modern day world. So let's get your health record digitized on a computer, and that's going to solve a lot of problems. Well, Charles, the title to that chapter is The Electronic Health Record, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. Because indeed, this is one of those things that have been promulgated and done in our healthcare delivery system, which has had some off-target consequences that were not originally intended and that we've had to live with and keep trying to fix with Band-Aid after Band-Aid after Band-Aid.
Generally, what would those be?
The ugly? Well, for instance, you know, the copy and paste. We all copy and paste, right? When you're copying and pasting health records, things get a bit dangerous. I remember working out in the Pacific Islands, out in Hawaii, to be precise. I remember opening up a patient's record. Patient was in the exam room with me, and I'm sitting at the laptop, and I'm looking at his record. I turn around to the patient. Comes time to examine him, and I say, "You had open heart surgery. Where's your scar?" And he looks at me like, "What planet are you on, Doc?" I said, "No, I mean, because I never had open heart surgery." And I said, "Just wait a minute." And I'm going back through the record, and Charles, visit after visit after visit after visit, going back in the history section of the electronic medical record, is this open heart surgery. So nobody bothered to ask him on each visit. They just copy and paste. So if there's an error,
yeah, that could be a disaster.
It just goes on and on and on. And Charles, when you're trying to get a nugget of information out of EMR, EMR is so complete. You might have 50 pages worth of medical records.
Now, what is EMR, electronic monitoring?
Electronic medical record.
Okay.
Think of EMR and EHR, electronic health record, an electronic medical record as synonymous. They're not quite, but they're pretty close.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can have 50 pages of EMR for a single hospitalization. And let's say you're now seeing this patient in another state, okay, a year later, and you're looking for a nugget of information. And you're going through page after page after page after page. It's sort of like looking for a flash drive, okay,
It's a lot of massive paperwork. Now, let me ask you, it seems to me that these sorts of records, and I think HIPAA does provide for this, are proprietary in that you're not allowed to release that information to anyone but the patient, and that the patient has full access to what's on those records. Is that true?
Not exactly. Again, I'm not being a HIPAA expert here, but there are groups of other individuals, okay, who are mainly providers, individuals or hospitals in whom you have allowed the physician to release those.
But you have to give them permission to look at the record.
In general, yes.
Can the government look at those records?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
Do they go to a massive computer center or is it very localized?
Most of your medical records are localized, and in fact, one EMR, electronic medical record system, has extreme difficulties talking and conversing with others. You know, years ago, back in the 70s, the military had an EMR, which was standardized for the entire military.
Right.
It wasn't the best, but it was standardized. The government, in their great wisdom, rather than taking that system and morphing it, this is a capitalist society. So they said, no, it's going to be privatized. And so, you know, 20 different software outfits came up with EMR, and they're all better probably than the original government version, but they can't talk to each other. So you go from hospital A to hospital B, and hospital A sends the records to hospital B, and you think you can interrogate those records with hospital B software, but tilt doesn't happen.
I actually think that's a good thing. I mean, I don't want to have all of these records in one system. And, you know, especially since the doctors now give you a questionnaire where they ask questions about your mental health, your psychology. They ask whether you have a gun in the house. They ask, you know, these are the kinds of questions, I mean, that I never will answer. But you know, it's not the kind of stuff you necessarily want to go into a massive database that could have access, the government could have access to.
Agreed. Agreed.
Maybe I'm just being a little paranoid here, but
No, I leave those questions blank too.
yeah. And also with there was talk for a brief period about electronic passports around the vaccine. And that could have had a chip on there that would have had everything about you from the time of your birth right up, all accessible. And I mean, here in Boston, the new mayor, Michelle Wu, actually signed a decree, I guess you could call it, saying that you had to show a passport to go into a restaurant or a store. Everybody ignored it and it went away. And I think then you had the Canadian truckers come out and that destroyed all of this. But there was a brief period of time when we were heading in that direction. And I think that would have been really a very dangerous slide away from of individual freedom.
We're having a lot of very dangerous slides in a whole lot of areas, of which you're very, very aware, Charles.
Yes, and the other thing, and I don't have any data on this, maybe you can answer this, Michael, from your own experience, but I noticed that during the pandemic, and again, I want to be careful here because YouTube will ban me. I'm simply expressing an opinion. I'm not making a theory or I noticed that my doctor, who is a doctor at a major hospital here in Boston, it's the biggest hospital in the city, it's world famous hospital. I'm not going to mention the name, but you know what it is.
Correct.
She, her attitude changed in terms of her candor to me about certain things to do with the pandemic, to do with early treatment, to do with vaccines, to do with things like immunity and other issues, the masking, all of it. And it's almost like she became a different person. And it makes me think that, and she'll still a wonderful doctor, and I still see her. But it makes me wonder, and maybe this is my tin hat, I'll agree. Did Obamacare have like laws in it that removed or compromised the independence of our doctors? Are they now not allowed to say certain things or do certain things? Can they get in trouble if they do? I mean, is there now like a, has there been a standardization of care in that you no longer have the medical doctor who graduated from a top medical school and who did an internship and served for 8 years and then has, is in a position to make judgments and their relationship with their patient versus some kind of a state apparatus that now basically gives them dictates in terms of what they can and can't do.
I don't think Obamacare did that, but certainly in the last, I think, since COVID, lots of individuals, providers have been, yanked from social media for stating facts. Notice I used that word, stating facts that were not commensurate with the government's party line. And that may have made everybody, including those not on social media, have a little more trepidation as to what they
It
say.
was kind of an informal intimidation. And we're talking here, and again, we can't get into it too much because we are on social media right now. But we're talking about some of America's top doctors, including one of the inventors of the RNA process in the vaccine, who suddenly, by expressing a slightly different opinion on the efficacy of the vaccine, when it should be used, where it should be used, they've been banned for
Yep, they
doing
think
that. I
that's
mean,
correct.
this is, this is the United States of America. The fact that this would be happening here is, it reminds me of probably some of the experiences that my grandparents' generation had as living as Jews in Nazi Germany. Okay, I don't want to get too dramatic, but this is not, this is like a very authoritarian and fascist development. And I'm not saying it's something that is done formally. I think you touch on it, Michael, when you say that they're, these it's more like a kind of an intimidation thing that
It
people
may
kind
be
of.
for the majority of providers, It may be subliminal, Charles. You know, they're not consciously thinking of doing that, but, you know, the media has put out so many woke, if you will, guidelines that they're a little bit leery. They're a little bit leery of, you know, saying something that they may be called on the carpet for by the medical society or whatever. And, you know, it's a capitalist private practice environment, and they don't want to have their careers yanked.
That's right. And look, I also am a strong believer in elementary medicine, conventional medicine. If you have cancer, you have heart disease, you have any of these, you have diabetes. Look, I take medication for just something. I mean, it's, you know, these are important disciplines. But at the same time, I think that there's what we might euphemistically call alternative medicines, traditional medicines, vitamins, minerals, and other modalities that have value as well. And I think an informed consumer does both and learns from both. But yet our establishment does not really give much time to anything but the former. And that includes medical school. I don't think they spend too much time in medical school talking about, for example, vitamin C, which Dr. Linus Pauling proved is very effective in treating various diseases. Is that true?
Time, Charles, and resources, okay? Many of the nutraceuticals that are out there, and this is another hat that I fly, I'm one of about 300 physicians, MDs and DOs, who actually have board certification in clinical pharmacology. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that there's no resources. I mean, think about this. Okay. Something that's available over the counter, which is inexpensive, what major pharmaceutical company is going to sponsor a phase 3 trial with 10,000 patients in it, going to get that data to show efficacy or a lack of efficacy? It's not going to happen.
It's because there's no money in it.
That's right. It's just not going to happen. So unfortunately, for many of the nutraceuticals that are out there, and nutraceutical is still, despite this, a multi-billion dollar industry, the data is, you know, 30 patients in this study and 20 patients in that study, and you can market anything as a nutraceutical. The federal government says you can state anything in your marketing of a nutraceutical, provided that you have shown us safety data. That is, it probably won't kill the individual who's taking it or give life-lasting harm. Well, man, that's a pretty open book.
Right.
It's a long stretch from efficacy, but that's the way it is.
And also, you know, things like vitamins, I mean, I think that there should be more regulation there, because we need to have a Food and Drug Administration that kind of gives a seal on those so we know what's in them. Because
they give good and standard practices, which means the manufacturing, you know, was not contaminated. Right. And if it has a USP label on it, which I suggest to your viewers that they try to find nutraceuticals that do, certain vitamins do, that means that at least the United States Pharmacopeia has validated that what's in the bottle is what's in the bottle.
I also sense that, you know, look, we're talking about a business, and there are certain medicines that are not profitable. And we could mention a few of them that are related to early treatment of COVID, but I won't mention them because we'll be pulled off the air. But you know what I'm talking about, the H drug and the I drug, okay?
Right.
These are available to members of Congress and their staff, but not to the average American. And they're also available all over the world right now. And in some countries, apparently, particularly Latin America, over the counter. I'm not saying they should be. I think they should be administered by a doctor with a prescription. But the fact that they're not only not available in the United States except through informal channels, and doctors can get them, by the way, and the fact that they're demonized is a national disgrace. It has everything to do possibly with the levels of disease. I mean, I don't want to get, I'm afraid to even say that, but, you know, can you euphemistically comment on this?
Yeah. In fact, I can add one to you too. I won't mention the name of the drug, but an antidepressant that starts with F, we'll call it the F drug, had a major clinical trial in Brazil, thousands of patients.
Yeah. Okay,
they were randomized and looked at, I think, need for treatment beyond 28 days was one of the endpoints, but they were pretty valid endpoints. Mortality was not an endpoint, but there were some good concrete endpoints. And this drug was shown to be superior to placebo. So just recently, in the past few days, the investigators applied to our FDA for an emergency use authorization for that drug for outpatient treatment of COVID. They were denied. They were denied, even though the efficacy shown in that study, Charles, was as good as molnupiravir, which I believe is Merck's pill to be taken for outpatient COVID. Now, you know, the F drug is a lot cheaper than molnupiravir.
That's the problem.
I'm not going to go there, Charles.
No, okay. But we can't say more about this other than to say that there are certain substances, I would just mention quinine, that have been around for centuries and that have been used to treat viruses very effectively. I mean, you know, it's not a big mystery. You don't have to look too deeply. So, Michael, getting back to the topics of your book, and it's available at Amazon Books, Modern Healthcare Delivery, Deliverance or Debacle, A Glimpse from the Inside Out. Just talk a little bit more about your experience as a doctor and what you brought into the book.
Now, what I tried to do in the book is in each chapter, and there's something in the book, Charles, for everyone. Okay, my audience is providers at all levels, administrators, insurers, and lay individuals, both patients and would-be someday patients. There's something in there for everyone. Some chapters are more leaning toward certain individuals and other chapters towards other groups of individuals. So in each chapter, though, when I gave the facts, I tried to pepper it with my anecdotal experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And those, you know, that comes from 40 years of medicine and knowing, you know, what can happen to me as a patient, because I've been on all sides. I've been a patient too.
Yeah.
So I've been a private practitioner, Charles. I've been a director of cardiology at a community hospital. I've been a vice president of an independent physician practice association. I've been a board member of a hospital practice. I've been a chief of cardiology at an academic medical center, the ninth largest public hospital in the country, professor of medicine at two universities of medicine, and I've been on a physician clinical reviewer for a large national radiology benefits manager. So unlike the pundits out there who practice for 5 years and now sit behind a desk, I've not talked the talk. I've walked the walk. So my anecdotes are powerful. And yeah, I'll be happy to share one or two of them with you because I think they're very, very eye-opening.
Please do.
I remember when I signed up for a staff position at a hospital, everybody has to get a physical exam. So I go for my physical exam and, you know, I'm a board certified cardiologist. I know how to examine the heart. So I'm sitting on the table and a young physician, not an extender, but a young physician walks in and I have my shirt off, but my undershirt is on. And she takes her stethoscope, dip, 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 literally, Charles, like 1 second in each spot. And that's the end of the cardiac exam. So I looked at her and I said, would you like me to take my undershirt off for a better exam? And her answer was, oh, no, that's not necessary. I just fill in the blanks. She knew she was talking to a physician when she said this. Charles, I couldn't believe my ears. Okay.
So that's terrible.
You know, that's one. Another one, I believe, and I emphasize this in the book in a chapter called What the Heck Ever Happened to Marcus Welby, MD.
Mm-hmm.
I emphasize that physicians, providers of all types are rushed. Okay. It's how many patients can you see per day that determines whether I give you a job as an employed physician. Indeed, if you interview for any of these positions at all these hospitals, including yours, I can guarantee you, okay, at the best of hospitals, you won't get to the person-to-person interview unless you answer a series of questions first. And many of them are good questions, but there's always one in there. And how many patients can you see comfortably per hour?
Oh, my.
Why? What's that got to do with the practice of medicine? But it has everything to do today with the modern practice of medicine. And when I started at this other organization, we were starting a new outpatient department of cardiology. And so we were building this from the ground up. And I sat around with the dean of the university, the chief of clinical cardiology, and a few other administrators. We're trying to decide how long should we make the patient visits. So I said, look, a new patient cardiology visit, somebody I've never seen, I want 40 minutes. In that time, I take my history, do my physical, sit down at the computer, review my lab work, review my x-rays, dictate my note. That's as fast as I think a new patient should be done. And I want 20 to 30 for a follow-up visit. Charles, they looked at me cross-eyed and said, cannot do. I said, what do you mean cannot do? They said, that's too long. We want 30 minutes at most for a new visit and 15 for a follow-up. I said, look, maybe you have better skills than I have. I said, in 15 minutes, I'm lucky I can get the patient's name correct on a piece of paper.
You have to look at somebody. Right. Now this is,
And the dean of the university sat there stone-faced during the entire encounter.
Now this is this for a hospital? What about like a private? Are there any more like sole practitioners? I mean, look, my father was a veterinarian. He wasn't a doctor for people, but I remember as a kid, he had his black bag. He'd get called out. You know, he had an office, but he'd get called out for an emergency. I remember going with him to someone's house. He'd have to pull a hot dog out of a dog's throat or something. And, you know, he would spend time and he would go there and he would really do the work. And, you know, it was not rushed at all. I mean, he would take a lot of time and a lot of care with each of the patients. I mean, is that something that's gone now?
Yes. Again, read the chapter two. I think it's 2. What the heck ever happened to Marcus Welby, MD?
No.
Yes. And the number of individual private practitioners over the last 2 decades, down and down and down and down. Okay. Now it's large physician groups and salaried employees by hospitals, HMOs.
Now, what if a young doctor coming out of medical school wants to do a private, you know, like get, you know, develop relationships with a family and maybe a slightly rural community and, you know, do what doctors used to do. You know, they would take care of the family. They take care of the children. When the children grow up, they take care of their children. And it would really become a fully whole, you know, very lifelong experience. Can a doctor do that now?
With the exception of concierge medicine, which is certainly not going to be in your rural areas that
right.
you talked about. With that exception, very, very difficult. And I talk about this in the book too, the discrepancy, the disconnect between what we call EM services, evaluation and management services, versus surgical services, the reimbursement, the disconnect between those two. Despite the government's quote unquote attempt to resolve that in the past 3 decades, remains humongous. So that if you're a doctor, a GP, an FP, a primary care physician, okay, and you're taking the insurance as payment, if you want to pay off that medical school bill and have a decent standard of living, you will be pushed into the time warp machine of scheduling that patient every 20 minutes, or you just can't make it anymore with your overhead. That's why they're joining hospitals, or they're joining large medical groups where that overhead can be smoothed out, massaged out over a number of physicians.
Now, I want to ask you a question just of general health. If you see a picture of Americans on the beach, like maybe in the early 1960s, the body types were very normal. If you see the same picture today, a large percentage, more than half of the people are obese. Now, it seems to me that they're putting sugar and chemicals in everything. If you look at the ingredients, and people are fat. And that's why there were so many people who died of COVID. If you look at the stats, I don't think I'm getting in trouble here, but I think that's now been established. I think it's at least 70 to 80% of people who died of COVID, which is basically a respiratory disease, were fat. And you know, is this, I mean, yeah, are they doing this? I mean, I hear, like, my daughter talks about this, that they put the sugar in because it makes you hooked on it and it's addictive. And so you want more and you end up, you know, like Dunkin' Donuts. So I'm not to bring single them out, but, you know, they inject the sugar into just about everything and it makes you crave that. And it's creating a nation that's fat, and that's business for the medical industry, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, all the rest.
Yeah. It's an epidemic.
Yeah.
The obesity is an epidemic. And again, whether it's a deliberately designed epidemic or not, I don't know.
I don't think it's deliberate. I just think it's making money. I mean,
we can call it addiction.
The fast food companies think they can make more money by putting sugar in, and the medical industry makes more money from the product.
Correct. As I said, I'm not sure it would classify in the psychiatric literature as an addictive substance, but there's no question. If you have sugar as a daily consumption and you cut it out, you do go through what I would call a certain type of withdrawal.
Well, it's a refined substance. It doesn't have any nutritional value. You know, if you eat a raw piece of, like, a sugar beet, that has nutritional value. It has fiber. It has, you know, other elements. But in the refining process, it becomes almost like, you know, it becomes like cocaine. I mean, it's like a drug. It goes right into your bloodstream.
But you are correct. If you look at BMI, which is an index of our fatness,
mm-hmm.
index of your weight divided by your height, in essence, it's definitely gone up and up and up every decade. We are becoming fatter, fatter, and fatter. I mean, I go to the supermarket.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, Mrs. Eman and I, we drink seltzer. That's our beverage, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at the shopping carts. I can't believe it. There's like 10 six-packs of sodas. These people must drink soda in place of water.
It's liquid candy. And so isn't orange juice, by the way. You know, any of those juices, it's loaded with sugar. I mean, I try to drink like the non-sugar, the polar water.
Right.
But, you know, it's this stuff is everywhere. It's, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to go too far into this. I've even heard like that the so-called diet drinks are even worse than the sugar drinks.
Well, but it's tied to many diseases. You name some. Okay, it's tied to atherosclerotic disease. It's certainly tied to hypertension disease. Okay,
right.
It's tied to diabetes, and there's some evidence it may be tied to certain types of cancer.
Sure.
So, you know,
it would make sense that it would be, because you do that to yourself daily. You're not gonna. It's not wholesome. It's not healthy.
Now, you know, some people years ago, and I don't know that I was totally against this. I mean, I'm pretty strong on not having the government interfere with my life. But a couple of people suggested years ago, they said, you know, the government gets their hands into a lot of things that probably they shouldn't get their hands in. Why not diet? Okay. You can't take things off the grocery shelf, but suppose you heavily taxed things that are not good for you, that the entire scientific community agrees is not good for you. You can buy it, but you pay 20% tax instead of 7% sales tax on that item. I thought about that, and I said, you know, that's not such a terrible idea.
No.
If the government's going to interfere in something, let's make the people healthy at least. And then I thought about it, and I said, you know, but it's a slippery slope, and we go from there. You know where it goes, Charles.
Right. So, Michael Zima, your book is available at, as I say, Amazon. Anywhere else?
Yes, Barnes & Nobles. It's available in both places, digitally and in hard copy. And also available at Apple Books and Google Play.
And the book is Modern Healthcare Delivery, Deliverance or Debacle, A Glimpse from the Inside Out. And my guest is Michael J. Zima, MD. Michael, it's been a very interesting conversation. I'd like to have you back from time to time. to discuss health issues within the context of what we're allowed to talk about. So
it would be my pleasure, Charles, to do that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. Have a good evening, sir.
You too.
Thank you.